Once a week, we turn to our friends at America's Test Kitchen to give us the lowdown on what's going on in that busy kitchen of theirs. They're hard at work, as always, pulling together information to empower the home cook. Tucker Shaw joins us today. He heads up the team behind Cook's Country. Tucker, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me today, Lynn.
Now, I know you love to update everybody about what's happening in the kitchen, you know, the tips and the tricks. So what are the tips and the tricks at the moment?
Well, one thing that we've been experimenting with a little bit, and you and I have talked about this a little before, is using non-dairy milks. And so one of the banes of using a non-dairy milk for a coffee drink is that it just doesn't froth the way that, you know, cow's milk will do.
Right, right.
And the reason for that is, you know, in cow's milk, the proteins in the milk sort of form little walls around the air bubbles and kind of hold everything in place. And our favorite method at home when using cow's milk is to take a French press, fill it about one-third with cold milk, and then froth it vigorously, and I mean really go for it, about 20 times. The milk will expand, and then you stick it in the microwave for about 30 seconds on high, and the foam will continue to rise. And once it fills up your French press, you're ready to spoon it onto your drink. If you froth it too warm or too hot, the milk won't sort of accept and hold on to quite as much air, and the walls around those bubbles won't be quite as strong. So the problem with non-dairy milks is, of course, they don't have the same protein content, and they don't froth as well with this technique or with any technique, really. And we tried in vain with almond milk, soy milk, rice milk, coconut milk, all the milks you can think of. But what we found was, if you look for an ingredient on the label that's called gelin, which is G-E-L-L-A-N, that is a additive. It's a natural polysaccharide made from a bacteria that occurs in a lily plant. And it creates a very similar matrix to the proteins that you will get in cow's milk. So if you find a product with gelin, and it's not totally weird, it's a natural product, it's been around for 30 or 40 years, and give it a froth, it should hold on to your froth a little bit more tightly.
Huh. Is it possible to get our hands on some of this stuff to add to, you know, the milks that don't have it as an ingredient?
Probably, but I think you'd probably have to jump through a whole lot of hoops to do that and find a specialty retailer probably online or something like that. But more and more of the products on the market do have this ingredient in them, so it's pretty easy to find it at the grocery store. Yeah.
Tip or another trick?
So here's the bane. Speaking of banes, the bane of the last-minute supper is when you get home from the office and you decide, hey, let's have some chicken cutlets or a nice pork chop for supper tonight, and you find that all your meat is in the freezer and not ready for cooking. So if you are working with a relatively thin piece of meat, and I'm talking about less than 1 inch, and you have forgotten to stick it in the fridge in the morning before you left for the office, and therefore it's still frozen when you get home, our normal method has always been to place this thin cut of meat onto a steel sheet pan or maybe a cast iron skillet that's at room temperature. Now, the metal has a rapid heat transfer or temperature transfer, so that would safely thaw that piece of meat in about an hour. But an hour can be a long time to wait if you're feeling hungry. So our new method, and this has been tested by the USDA and is considered safe, you take your chicken breast or your relatively thin pork chop or steak or whatever it is, and you stick it into a Ziploc bag. And then you submerge that into hot tap water. And I'm talking about 140 degrees, which is about the upper level of hot tap water, and it will be thawed in about 8 minutes, and you'll be ready to go.
That is such a cool thing, and I'm glad to hear the USDA tested it, because I've been testing it for a long time.
Well, you'll be happy to know then that the rate of bacterial growth at that temperature for that short of time it still falls into the safe category as far as they're concerned. Now, if you're doing it with a chicken breast, you might notice a little bit of an opaque exterior on the chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
don't sweat it, because once you cook that piece of chicken, it won't affect the final dish at all, and it's basically indistinguishable from one that's been thawed to room temperature.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I have to say, I'm so glad to hear this, but don't leave it just sitting there. You know, really get it out of there and get it cooking, right?
Yeah, get it cooking. Yeah. And this is really for, you know, I'm hungry now kind of situation. Don't leave it out longer. Put it in the fridge and let it thaw in there.
What is your take on basting?
Basting
a roast, a chicken, that kind of thing? Because I have a theory, and I'd love to know what you think.
Well, so basting is like one of those cooking questions, those eternal cooking questions that, you know, we sort of, you know, answer generationally. People have been talking about it for decades or hundreds of years. And the inconclusivity of it, or the apparent inconclusivity of it, sort of makes for fun conversation. But we decided we wanted to put this to rest. So the promise of basting is, of course, meat that is more moist and skin that's a little bit more brown. The question is whether it's worth the work to open up the oven every few minutes roasting and so forth. So we tested this on our first test was with three turkey breasts, and we did this on just breasts rather than full birds so that we could minimize whatever variables might exist with birds. With the first breast, we roasted it at 350 degrees, and we basted it every 20 minutes with the liquids that came out of the breast.
Right.
With the second breast, we roasted it, and rather than basting, we simply opened and closed the door every 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That would replicate the heat loss that you would get from opening the oven. And then the third breast, we just stuck it in the oven and let it rip. Once they all reached 160 degrees, which is our target, we weighed them. So weighing them at this point helps us determine how much moisture loss they suffered in the oven.
Uh-huh.
And it was a wash. They were all between about 22.5% to 24%. So there was no scientific benefit or measurable benefit in terms of moistness to basting.
So the moisture didn't increase because of the basting?
No.
Which is kind of logical, because the moisture doesn't get through the skin and everything else.
Exactly. If you really do think it through. But what basting did do, but only in a very, very, very minor way, was slightly improve the browning on the exterior of the turkey. And this is because that basting liquid, of course, has proteins and fat and amino acids and the kinds of things that you need to have to create a Maillard reaction in your oven at that heat. So you'll get a very small sort of prettiness benefit from basting, but it's not significant. And it's, you know, it takes longer. We found that the turkey breasts took about 10 minutes longer when you're opening and closing the oven.
Right.
To do the basting, so it's probably not worth it. So we're on the no-baste team.
Uh-huh. Well, I disagree. No, only because I think if you're basting with something like wine, you're building up flavor and the skin, you know, of a bird, and that is something I like. But let's move on. What other tips and tricks are up your sleeve right now?
So the final tip I want to talk about today is it's a little bit surprising to me that it took us so long to kind of figure out this tip. Most of our recipes in the test kitchen are developed on a gas stove, but we also cross-test everything on electric stoves to make sure that whatever recipes we put out, you know, will work in as many kitchens as possible. And often you will find when you're doing a recipe for something on the stovetop that it will ask you to start, for example, on a high heat, and then reduce the heat quickly to finish cooking something. And this is to create a sear or some other sort of exterior kind of benefit to whatever it is that you're cooking. So vexing problem when you are on an electric stove, because when you turn down the heat doesn't immediately back off. You have residual heat stuck in the coil or wherever it is. So I'm not sure if this is an aha moment or a duh moment, but what we determined is the best way to reduce heat quickly on an electric stove is once you're finished with the high heat, move it to another burner that you've already turned on to low. So you do end up using two burners for the same dish. But if you have one burner on high, get your sear, and then quickly move it to a burner that's been preheated to low, you will immediately change the amount of heat that's being transferred to the pan. So it replicates turning down a flame.
I'd call that an aha moment.
Okay, good.
Tucker, thank you. Great tips and tricks.
Lynn, thank you so much for having me.
Tucker Shaw heads up the Cook's Country team at America's Test Kitchen. Now, you can find a rundown of Tucker's tips at splendidtable.org.